I'm Ken McLeod. From the day we launched unfetteredmind.org, it has operated without a paywall, advertising, or a subscription charge. This is only possible through the generosity of people like you. If you find our materials useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate. Thank you, and enjoy this podcast.
Unfettered Mind: The Nuts and Bolts of Buddhist Schools and Retreats.
One of the strengths of the Tibetan tradition of Buddhism is that it inherited virtually all of the teachings of Indian Buddhism. The Theravadin, which became known in the Tibetan tradition as the Hinayana, and the Mahayana teachings, compassion and emptiness, and the Vajrayana teachings, including deity practice, energy transformation, and direct awareness. And in that sense, Tibetan Buddhism is unique. Theravadin tradition inherited the earlier teachings that had migrated before the ethic of compassion became a central component of Buddhism. And China, for some reason or other, never took to the Vajrayana. I mean, there are elements of Vajrayana scattered through Chinese Buddhism, and there's references to the Black Hat sect, which of course is the Karmakaju, and so forth, even though the Karmapas and some of the Sakya patriarchs were priests to the emperors, but that was mainly the Mongolian emperors, not the actual Chinese emperors. And Japan, of course, inherited the Mahayana tradition from China, but just the very vestiges of Vajrayana. So Tibet is quite unique. However, one of the things that has come out of that is a kind of hierarchy of practice. So you have the Hinayana and the Mahayana and the Vajrayana. And there's a certain amount of polemics, shall we say, about the various relationships. Now, you take something like Dzogchen. Dzogchen is a direct awareness practice, like Mahamudra, like Path and Fruition in the Sakya system, and so forth, like the Great Middle Way. It's very sophisticated. And I had the pleasure of doing a retreat in Dzogchen, studying one of Longchenpa's treasuries, the treasury of basic space. That was very good. And one of the things that Longchenpa does in this is to go through all of the other approaches to practice and discuss their shortcomings. Now, there's great benefit in that. There's also a great danger. And it's very easy for people who, out of a feeling of loyalty or devotion to a tradition and a way of practice, to not understand that when Longchenpa is exposing the shortcomings in a particular approach to practice, he's really talking about what is happening individually. and the individual. He's not actually criticizing the school. So, for instance, he says, there's one verse about the those who follow the bodhisattva path getting caught up in the sophistry of negating self. Well, I don't know how many of you have looked at Geoffrey Hopkins' Meditations on Emptiness. Anybody know this? It's like this thick. And it's a very, very detailed philosophical analysis of the concept of emptiness. Utterly boring from my point of view. But that's one of the things that happens when we practice. How many of you have had a little internal debate about what is emptiness, et cetera, inside you? And this is really what Longchamp is pointing to, is that tendency. He's not, he's using language, but he's not really lambasting the whole Mahayana tradition. Now, yesterday, in discussing the skepticism or wrong views, I made reference to a description of refuge, which I'll actually read. To take refuge in Buddha is to rest in the emptiness of original mind, free from any reference or defining characteristic. To take refuge in the Dharma is to experience the clarity of original mind, the natural awareness that knows what experience is and how experience arises. To take refuge in the Sangha is to be one with the unimpeded arising and subsiding experience, free from the three poisons of attraction, aversion, and indifference. Okay, what tradition is that from? Pardon? Baptist. What does it sound like? Sounds like Vajrayana. Pardon? It's a Theravadan formulation. Yeah. Changed a couple of words. It's basically a Theravadan formulation. And in Los Angeles, I started a group of teachers. And we have representatives from the Tibetan, Theravadan, and the Zen traditions. We've been having a number of discussions. We meet about every 2 or 3 months. And we spend an hour talking about scripture or teachings, an hour on practical teaching matters, teaching skills, and then an hour on practical matters like how to organize a retreat or something like that. So it's very fruitful. And in the last meeting that we had, there's a person, one of the other teachers, and it's a very bright and, to my taste, a refreshingly eccentric Theravadan teacher who knows Pali and translates, so it's very good. And we were discussing the first two verses of the Dhammapada, which is this poem of aphorisms. And this particular text wasn't translated into Tibetan until the 19th century, which is horrifically late. And the translation of the Tibetan is significantly different in the opening line from all the other translations into English. It starts, and so I raised this point. I said, is this word existent in the Pali? And the word for nature, it says, I think it's all experience, it's the nature of mind. Yeah, and because I thought, this doesn't sound like a Theravadan formulation. And he said, no, it isn't. And you Mahayana essentialists, And I just laughed. Because the Hinayana has been set up as a straw dog by the Mahayanists to make the Mahayana look good. But when you really get into the practice, no, it's absolutely the case. But when you really get into the Theravadan tradition, you find things like this all through it. And it was just such a delight to appreciate that the Mahayanists had been set up by the Theravadins as a straw dog, accusing them of essentialism, which is the cardinal sin in Buddhism. You know, you think there's actually a self, a thing? There's an essence to mind? What kind of nonsense is this? So, the reason for this digression is, in your practice, we all have our own formulations and the things that we are comfortable with. But make sure that you understand the meaning in the formulations of other traditions. Don't just pick at the words. Because my own experience is there isn't a heck of a lot to choose, pick and choose from. They've all really got some very, very important things. Just want to underline that. I find factionalism and sectarianism in Buddhism quite distasteful. And there's enough of it in other ways going on in the world. I don't think we need to contribute to it. Okay.
This is from Sharon in San Francisco. Embedded in Tibetan teachings is the implication that those teachings are superior to the Hinayana teachings. If taken literally, this conjures a feeling of divisiveness and pride. What do the Tibetan teachings mean by stating they are superior to other teachings?
Ah, if it only stopped there. We need to look at things historically here. The Mahayana, or what we now know as the Mahayana teachings, evolved out of the earlier schools of Buddhism, such as the Satantikas and the Shtavardins. I can't pronounce these names. The Shtavardins evolved into what is now known as the Theravadan tradition in Southeast Asia. Satantikas evolved into a school of philosophy, and then you had such ones as the Madhyamakas and Yogacharas and so forth, all evolving. It is human nature when you are part of or following one set of teachings and in a highly competitive environment, as they were in those days for reasons I'll explain in a minute, that you're going to develop ways in which you can say your teachings have a special quality. Almost all traditions do this one way or another. I'm not sure that the Hinayana ever existed as a school. It was very much a creation of the Mahayanists, a straw dog, if you wish, to which to sing the praises of the Mahayana. So, yes, there is this sense of superiority. Certainly one gets that when one reads these texts. But it's not clear that they were actually criticizing anything that wasn't just a creation. At least that's how it was in India. The Tibetans, I'm sure, because they weren't exposed to Indian Buddhism directly after the 11th century, I'm sure they felt there was such a school as the Hinayana. But and from there, from the Tibetan point of view, they would always object. If they said, if people said, well, you regard the Hinayana teachings as inferior, they would say, no, no, that there's the base, which is the Hinayana, and out of that you build the Mahayana, out of that the Vajrayana. So there's a progression here, but they're all important. And it's within the Tibetan tradition. We have, for instance, in the Nyingma tradition, we have actually nine vehicles. There's the Pracheka Buddhayana, then the Shraveka Buddhayana, and so forth, through the Bodhisattva Yana, and then the lower tantras and the higher tantras. And there's a progression there. It's better, in my opinion, to interpret these mythically, if you wish, that the criticisms that are being leveled are really criticizing latent tendencies in everybody to believe certain beliefs, certain attitudes, certain things that we hold on to. And in the practice of Buddhism, sooner or later, we have to let every one of those go. People naturally take pride rejoice in something that they find of great personal value. And that comes out often as expressed as the joy and the exuberance and praise that you find in many of the sutras, in contrast to other forms of practice which the individual didn't find as helpful. But to feel that one is superior to others because one is doing this, this, as you suggest in your question, is a form of pride, and that is a reactive emotion, which inevitably involves some kind of ignoring, and that's going to be problematical. Two small points in conclusion. There's a group of teachers that I'm part of that meets here every 2 or 3 months, and we just get together and discuss various topics. And one of the teachers in that is a wonderful Theravadan teacher, very deeply trained and very, very knowledgeable, and I have a great deal of respect for him. And one time we were discussing the first verse of the Dhammapada, the Tibetan translation versus the standard translations from the Pali, which is a little different. And in the middle of this discussion, he said, "Oh, you Mahayana essentialists." And I recognized that when he said that, which you said lightly, of course, that the Mahayana was just as much a straw dog for the Theravadins as the Hinayana is a straw dog for the Mahayanists. So this is a human tendency. If you find yourself subject to pride, knock on wood. And the origin for that actually is in Greek mythology, where hubris is the god of pride, and Nemesis is what brings pride or punishes pride. When you knock on wood, you're paying homage to Nemesis, who is a wood spirit. So that should keep you safe.
This question was submitted by James in Santa Rosa, California. What are the benefits of doing the 3-year retreat? Is the retreat effective in the context of our California lifestyle?
The 3-year retreat was is a Tibetan institution, primarily, I think, in the Kagyu Nyingma traditions, in which you receive and practice meditation in all the various meditations and forms of practice of that tradition. It's very powerful. And it was originally intended to provide you with the experience and training so that you could become a full-time contemplative, a mountain yogi, if you wish. You ask, is the retreat effective in the context of our California lifestyle? The retreat is not effective in any form of lifestyle, any culture. It is, it's about spiritual practice, pure and simple. It's not about becoming a member of society. It's preparing for a life of contemplation. And one prepares and trains for the three-year retreat because this is how one wants to lead one's life. It isn't a springboard to any kind of profession. Though many of the people who've done three-year retreats have become teachers, it's not really intended as a teacher training. It is a wonderful training in spiritual practice, and so it is intended for people who want to make spiritual practice the center for their lives.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.